From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. During the last U.S. Supreme Court confirmation battle, critics argued that now Justice Brett Kavanaugh represented a threat to the United States Constitution. We'll hear a Campbell Law School expert's response to that claim. Congressmen on Capitol Hill recently paid tribute to the late Walter Jones, Jr. You'll hear highlights from the remarks about the longtime representative from eastern North Carolina. The history of American business includes frequent episodes of fraud. A Duke University professor documents that history in a recent book. He shares his findings. And we'll dive into North Carolina's complex rules and regulations governing alcohol. Many of them predate national prohibition. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
There will be a new election. That is the word from the State Board of Elections following a four-day hearing into allegations of ballot shenanigans in the 2018 election for North Carolina's 9th Congressional District. The unanimous board decision came not only after riveting testimony, but after a call by the Republican candidate himself, Mark Harris, for a new election, even though he appeared to have won that race on election night last fall. Carolina Journal's editor-in-chief Rick Henderson has been following all of this very closely. He joins us now with the details and what comes next. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Donna.
Just an incredible story. Of course, this is a national story
right. Following
this race, which had been the lone undecided race in the entire country. Here's the thing. Mark Harris, the Republican candidate, he'd actually already gone off to Washington, D.C. at one point and had repeatedly called for his victory, his election night victory, to be certified by the state board. And then he did a 180.
Right. Within 24 hours, he went from the point, and the state Republican Party, from the point of saying Mark Harris won this election. No one challenged any of the results at the time. He should be certified. He should go to Washington, too. I think there should be a new election and presumably withdrawing his interest in running in that new election, though we don't know that for sure.
This all stemmed from testimony that really was just incredible over the 4 days, talking with different people who had worked in Bladen County, election workers, people who were working, trying to get ballots from people. Did we uncover, or did the board investigators actually uncover illegal, fraudulent activity related to ballots?
On social media, I said it's rare that in real life we actually see a legal proceeding where there is a Perry Mason moment. You know, and we actually saw several during the course of this hearing. But yes, we heard testimony under oath of people who were hired by McCray Dallas, the operative who is the center of this investigation, people who were hired by him essentially to not only order ballots for people, which is perfectly legal, but to collect those ballots, sometimes before they were completely filled out, to witness them falsely, to put stamps on them, and then to put them in the mail. Every step after actually ordering the ballot is illegal, or at least everything after maybe handing a ballot to a person from a mailbox. But everything after that is against the law, very clearly against the law. Election workers are trained that they can't do that. McCray Dallas allegedly told Andy Yates, the campaign consultant for the Harris campaign, and Mark Harris himself, he didn't do anything like that. But we had people testify under oath that, yes, he did, and he paid me to do it.
Do we have any idea whether votes were changed? I mean, anything or perhaps ballots thrown away or any word like that to know that this was really tampering with people's votes?
We don't know that there were any ballots that were thrown away. There were a number, a very significant number in the four figures of absentee ballots that were ordered and were not cast. Now, that could well be because people ordered the ballots and then decided to vote in person, which is a perfectly legal thing to do, and people do that quite often. What we do know from the testimony of the people who were there at the trial is that they would occasionally fill out ballots that had races in which there were no votes cast at all. So they would simply take the ballot, and if, let's say, a vote had been cast for sheriff or for Congress, and there were down-ticket races where they were left blank, they would fill in the names on those or fill in the spots on those ballots and then put them in the envelopes and seal them.
Just incredible. I think anyone, no matter your affiliation politically or ideologically, I mean, the hair has to stand up on your arms. It did for me listening to some of that testimony about what apparently went on. What does that mean then for the operative that you mentioned, McRae Dallas, who apparently was the central figure in this action?
He was subpoenaed to appear at the hearing. He did so with his attorney. And once he appeared, his attorney said Mr. Dallas would testify under oath, but only if he were granted immunity from prosecution by the committee. The committee did not do that, didn't go with that deal. And part of it was citing a state law, which does not allow the State Board of Elections to do that. They can't grant, they're not allowed to grant immunity from prosecution in their hearings. And so when his attorney was informed that was the case, then they left. And so he has disappeared. We have no idea where he is right now. Certainly, if there are any criminal referrals that come forward from the State Board of Elections for this, Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman will be very interested in seeing him. She has a parallel investigation going on right now. There are some reports that the federal government is having an investigation of this. It's not the last we've heard of McRae Dallas. We just may not see him anytime soon.
And at least as of the point that you and I are talking here today, that's the situation about Mr. Dallas. Rick, there was one particular witness during this election board hearing over the 4 days. He testified for a number of hours, and this is truly riveting testimony. This was the son of the Republican candidate in this race, Reverend Mark Harris. Tell us about the son's testimony and the import of it.
John Harris's son is 29 years old. He's an attorney. He works in the civil division for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Eastern North Carolina. And he's worked at the General Assembly earlier and had some involvement in politics. But because of his role with the U.S. Attorney's Office, was not involved in his father's campaign at all. But they talked with some frequency. And John Harris, to the surprise of everyone there except for the state board staff who knew this was going to happen, appeared as witness on the third day of the hearing and basically said, I was informed about, I looked at the absentee ballot results in the 2016 election, which was a very close primary election in which Robert Pittenger, the incumbent, defeated Mark Harris by 134 votes and saw the third place candidate, Todd Johnson, who finished far in third place, got 400-some absentee ballots from Bladen County when the Pittenger and Harris between them got 10. And he wanted to find out more about this person, and especially because his father had expressed some interest in hiring Mr. Dallas. This turns out being McRae Dallas who did this. Wanted to know how he got so many absentee ballots in such a small area for one candidate when the others got none. And the main word that he got in this situation was that he suspected from looking at the methods of delivery of ballots, all of which are public records, that there probably was some sort of ballot harvesting operation going forward.
He told his father about that, right?
He emailed him. He talked to him on the phone about it. And he said he basically issued all sorts of different warnings that this guy may be shady. Let's make sure he's operating properly and all that. And apparently Mark Harris completely ignored it.
So, Rick, what do we know about the Democrat in this race, Dan McCready? Was he a part of the hearing at all?
He was represented by attorney Mark Elias, who's a very well-known national elections law attorney. He's worked for a number of prominent national candidates. We know that Dan McCready has raised $500,000 so far on the presumption of a new election, but he was not there at all, and his only role there was just to be represented by his attorney. But we assume that he's preparing for the next round.
Because of that unanimous vote by the Board of Elections, it was 5-0 to go forward with a new election. So what do we know? And what are the questions, really, that as voters we should be wondering about what comes next?
Okay. The State Board of Elections will set a date for a new election. Now, by state law, that means an entirely new election. That means that there will be a new candidate filing period. All five political parties that are recognized by the state can field candidates. There will be time allowed for a first and second primary if necessary before the general election, and those dates will all be set out by the State Board of Elections. So if there are no further glitches in the process, that's what we can expect next.
Just incredible. And as I mentioned, this is a national news story because there is an empty seat, frankly, at this point in the United States House of Representatives that should be occupied by the person who is representing the 9th District of North Carolina. So we will await the declaration of a date. At the point you and I are talking, we don't have a date yet, and then we'll go forward. And of course, Carolina Journal will be covering every element as we travel ahead on this really uncharted road here in North Carolina. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the debate over U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation, some critics complained about a potential threat to the U.S. Constitution if he did win confirmation. Well, does such a threat exist? That was the topic of a recent lecture our next guest delivered for the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Greg Wallace is a professor at Campbell University's Law School. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we did hear this quite a bit. Some people saying that if Brett Kavanaugh ends up on the U.S. Supreme Court, there's going to be a threat to the U.S. Constitution. Even a U.S. Senator, Kamala Harris, made this claim. When you heard these descriptions of Brett Kavanaugh, what did you think?
Well, I think they're misguided. I think what Kamala Harris is worried about is not a threat to the Constitution, which, by the way, she referred to as the little book in Judge Kavanaugh's pocket there. What she's concerned about is the threat to the sort of freewheeling judicial kind of decision-making that allows judges to really decide cases based on their political views and not really based on the text or history or tradition of the Constitution.
And those are really based on two different approaches to the Constitution, right? One is, let's look at the text, let's look at what it originally meant. The other is, well, it means what we say it means today.
Exactly. And that really is what these hearings were about. They were not really about Judge Kavanaugh's past. They were about judicial power. And Judge Kavanaugh would be a more reliable conservative on the court than Justice Kennedy. I don't think Judge Kavanaugh is going to go for making up constitutional rights or fundamental rights that have really no basis in the text or in the long tradition of our constitutional decision making. And so I think what they were concerned about was probably number one, abortion. Number two, I think probably gay rights. Both of these are sort of different sides of the same coin of this package of rights that we think of as rights dealing with sexual autonomy, and which, by the way, none of which are found in the Constitution. And I think that's what they're really concerned about.
We are chatting with Greg Wallace, professor at Campbell University's Law School. And you mentioned conservative, but Brett Kavanaugh would not even necessarily have to be personally conservative to rule in a way that these left-of-center partisans would dislike. If he's just following the Constitution, that would hurt their cause.
Yes, and I think that if you look at the history of the court, it is the more conservative justices who tend to be the textualist and the originalist on the court. The more liberal justices tend to be those that adhere to this sort of living constitution approach, where you kind of make up constitutional law like state common law judges do with the common law. They just kind of make it up based on whatever they think is right at the time.
Now, one of the things that is of interest is that Brett Kavanaugh, having been someone who's seen as more of a textualist or following the original meanings of the Constitution, some have said this doesn't necessarily mean he is a slam dunk vote for anything favoring Donald Trump. If the president tries something that's outside the bounds of the Constitution, Brett Kavanaugh is probably going to be one of those justices who will say, no, the Constitution doesn't say you could do it, so you can't.
Yes. In fact, if you look at his he wrote more than 300 opinions on his 12 years of the District of Columbia Circuit Court. And in many of those opinions, he takes a pretty strong stand for what we call the separation of powers. And in fact, he's very concerned about regulatory overreach, that is, overreach by the executive department. In fact, in at least 75 cases, he voted with the majority in cutting back on the reach of executive agencies. So I don't have any reason to think that he's going to rubber stamp the actions of President Trump.
One of the issues that has been of great importance in the courts involving North Carolina has been this whole idea of gerrymandering and redistricting and whether the courts should say anything about this. I've heard some on the left say that a Kavanaugh on the court probably means now that the Supreme Court is going to step away and say, that's a political issue. We shouldn't be dealing with it. Does anything from his past suggest that might be true?
Well, the partisan gerrymandering issue was a mess in the court before Judge or now Justice Kavanaugh arrived there. In fact, Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion in a case 10 or 12 years ago where when first presented with the issue of partisan gerrymandering, the court said, wow, we can't come up with any sort of workable standard for determining when it's too partisan. And so I think the court had an opportunity this past year, last year, to decide these cases, but it punted on standing grounds. So I don't know that Justice Kavanaugh would vote necessarily any different than a Justice Kennedy would on that case.
Looking at just the long-term future with Brett Kavanaugh on the bench, what do you see or how do you see him shaping future court cases coming out of the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that one of the mistakes that the Democrats made was to mount such an opposition to Justice Kavanaugh because, frankly, he probably is more of a moderate conservative than a lot of other choices President Trump could have made. I think he will probably be more like Justice Gorsuch, who, by the way, voted with Justice Kennedy more than any other justice on last year's term. I don't think he's going to be as conservative as, say, a Justice Thomas or a Justice Alito, but I think he's going to be more toward the conservative middle as we go forward.
And in fact, before the whole furor about Brett Kavanaugh, there were quite a few people, even on the legal left, who said, you know, of the people that Trump could have chosen, this would be someone that we should support.
And there were people on the right who didn't want Kavanaugh to be chosen for that very same reason. So I don't know kind of how predicting how justices are going to go. I mean, you know, the Republican appointees, three of the most hardened liberals, Stevens, you know, Brennan and Souter were all Republican appointees. So you don't know really how a justice is going to go when they get that lifetime appointment.
The other angle that probably is of interest to people is Justice Kennedy was a swing vote. So now that you have Kavanaugh, do you have a pretty strong 5-4 conservative block, or does Justice Roberts now become a swing vote? Do we know?
Well, I think that, Justice Kavanaugh is, if you look at his past decisions, and if that's a reliable guide, and he doesn't swing to the left like a few of these conservative appointed judges have done, I think he will be a more reliable conservative than Justice Kennedy. I don't think he's going to end up being the swing vote, which may push Chief Justice Roberts more to the middle and be the swing vote like he was in the Obamacare case.
Well, it certainly will be very interesting to watch. We know one person who's going to be watching very closely is Greg Wallace, professor at Campbell University's Law School. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Republican Congressman Walter Jones died recently. He had represented Eastern North Carolina in Congress for nearly a quarter century. Among those who paid tribute to Jones on Capitol Hill, longtime Democratic Congressman David Price.
Walter and I met long before either of us served in the House. We worked together on the North Carolina presidential campaign of Jimmy Carter in 1976. I have a photo on my desk to prove it, a very youthful-looking campaign team. Well, Walter went on to chart a different course politically, a course that was uniquely his own. In fact, he found himself frequently at odds with, if not one party, then the other. But by the same token, he sometimes found possibilities for alliances and cooperation in unexpected places, and did not hesitate to take those opportunities. This approach was rooted in Walter's strong conscience and his personal sincerity. He stood out in an age when sincerity is sometimes in short supply in our nation's politics, earning respect and admiration on both sides of the aisle.
Kentucky Republican Thomas Massey also paid tribute to Walter Jones.
Some people in Washington, D.C. kiss up and punch down. Walter often did the opposite. Walter would kiss down and punch up. He was a statesman and a true Southern gentleman who followed his heart while fighting for his constituents. And whether you agreed with him or not, Walter displayed the type of courage we could all hope to possess. He was willing to admit when he was wrong, like that time he voted for Jimmy Carter. He would admit it in front of God, in front of his colleagues, and to 750,000 constituents. That's true courage. Walter's conscience guided his every vote and action in the 6 years that I knew him. 11,266. That's the final number of letters that Walter Jones personally wrote, offering his apologies and condolences to the families of soldiers who lost their lives in the wars in the Middle East. You see, Walter eagerly voted for the Iraq War, but then later came to believe that he had made a grave mistake. Did he write those letters to prepare him for his next reelection? No. He wrote those letters to prepare him for this day, when he would be judged at the gates of heaven.
The entire U.S. House of Representatives held a moment of silence for Walter Jones, dead at 76, after almost a quarter century representing Eastern North Carolina in Congress. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Fans of free markets believe that transactions between buyers and sellers tend to produce the best outcomes for society. But those transactions depend on honesty on both sides of the bargain. And our next guest reminds us that there's a long history of dishonesty in the marketplace. Dr. Edward Ballison is professor of history at Duke University. He's author of the book Fraud, An American History from Barnum to Madoff, and he recently addressed the John Locke Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
Your book takes a look at the history of business fraud and the ways that the United States, either through government or outside of government, has addressed that fraud. How'd you get interested in the subject?
I've always been interested in the workings of American capitalism, actually, and particularly the fault lines of capitalism. My first book actually looked at bankruptcy in 19th century America, another fault line when people can't pay their debts. And in that endeavor, there's a very close relationship between those circumstances and when people start shading the truth. And that got me very interested in the question of just how pervasive dishonesty is within market contexts. And then even more importantly, from my perspective, what kinds of institutions do people come up with to deal with that problem?
Sounds as if you're calling this fraud in American history from Barnum to Madoff, that this has been part of our capitalism for as long as we can look back.
Oh, and I think one could make the point even broader. Humans are prone both to be honest and dishonest, and it depends on the context.
So tell us a little bit about what the book Fraud sets out to do.
It looks at about 200 years of American history. And surveys not only the kinds of the patterns of dishonesty in the marketplace, but more importantly, tracks over that two-century period how Americans have responded to the problem of fraud, whether through market mechanisms or quasi-public kinds of arrangements, through trade associations or non-governmental organizations often connected to the business community, or increasingly through use of state power, whether that's at the local, the state, or the national level.
And this has varied over time, hasn't it?
It really has. One of the central arguments of the book is that in the 19th century, we had in the United States what you might think of as a legal baseline of de facto caveat emptor, that Latin phrase meaning buyer beware. It wasn't that there were no legal prohibitions against deceit in commercial transactions. It's just that whether you're looking at the criminal law or civil law kinds of context, it was really hard to prove. You had to really show intent. And you had to convince a jury who might be skeptical and a judge who might be skeptical. And often the amount of harm involved was relatively low in any given instance to any given party. And so that was also a disincentive to actually marshal the forces necessary to bring anyone into a legal proceeding. So with that legal baseline of caveat emptor, one of the things that emerged were a large number of market responses to the problem of deception, which you see in any context. So things like the emergence of the accounting profession, or the creation of financial news to keep people abreast of what's going on in stock markets. The problem was that those types of responses were always subject to corruption. You could have rumors in the newspaper. You could have falsehoods in the newspaper trying to move a stock market. You could have fake advertising in newspapers. And so eventually in a growing number of markets, even as early as the mid-19th century, but even more so into the 20th century, one began to see coalitions emerge that involved sometimes businesses, often experts of one kind or another, sometimes politicians looking to make a name for themselves. And they would come together with proposals to do something more aggressive about limiting deception in economic contexts.
And the government did step in. And I understand that your book shows how the government grew and then stepped back and now perhaps is growing again.
Yes, although maybe stepping back again too. So there's a steady increase of anti-fraud policies in specific markets in the late 19th century, say around fake fertilizer and creating offices of official chemists in state governments to actually police fertilizer markets, inspect fertilizer, which you can't do as just a plain old farmer in the 1880s. The federal government gets involved with anti-mail fraud endeavors as early as the 1870s. But in it's around the New Deal when you really see much more significant expansion at the federal level with both the creation of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the expanded power for the Federal Trade Commission. Other statutes are important too, but those are the two agencies that I think have the biggest anti-fraud responsibility in the federal government. And those entities, along with a profusion of consumer protection agencies and anti-fraud divisions within state attorney general's offices and at the local level in district attorney's offices, really did create something along the lines of an anti-fraud state in the mid-20th century. But as with so many other contexts in the United States around the late 1970s, there was a turn away from stringent regulatory policy, and that showed up in this domain as well. Now, if one looks at the more recent history, the record is a little bit mixed. The Obama administration, on the one hand, created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, very much with anti-deception concerns in view, others as well. But that's also the moment when you see legislation passed like the Jobs Act, which actually reduced in a very significant way disclosure requirements on the part of new firms looking to raise capital. And now, of course, we're grappling with the Trump administration. And I think it's fair to say that that at least at the national level, concern about many of these issues in the federal government has declined in the last couple of years.
And while we have President Donald Trump on the other side, those who would like to run against him, some of them are very interested in either restoring or maybe even having more safeguards if they were able to enter the White House.
That's absolutely true, and I think the no one more so than Elizabeth Warren, whose research as a law professor was quite instrumental, actually, in structuring the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Your book really looks at the history of how this has ebbed and flowed. I'd like you to take off the historian hat for a second and put on your Carnac the Magnificent hat. Are we always going to see some sort of balancing act between letting the market take care of itself and having the government step in because the market's not going to be expert at taking care of itself completely?
Yes, because there are going to be gaps in information between buyers and sellers, especially in the kinds of markets we're dealing with today. One sees a pattern of generational amnesia. When fraud incidence goes down, people forget about it and they think about the costs associated with anti-fraud policies. And there are costs. There are trade-offs. There are trade-offs against the rule of law because the most effective anti-fraud policies can be fairly vigorous and immediate and raise questions about due process. There are trade-offs between innovation and anti-fraud policies because almost by definition, if you're going to be very closely policing the kinds of marketing that people can do, you're going to be limiting innovative behavior in the marketplace. Those trade-offs are not easy to make, and I think what we see is a pattern, as you described quite well, of tilting in one direction or the other and then making corrections.
Well, it's certainly an interesting topic and probably one that's going to be ripe for follow-ups. You could do new additions to this book as we move forward in the years ahead. Dr. Edward Ballison is professor of history at Duke University, also the author of the book Fraud, An American History from Barnum to Madoff. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It has been 8 decades since our state's alcoholic beverage control system was devised, and now some members of the North Carolina General Assembly believe it is well past time to modernize this outdated system. Our next guest agrees. John Sanders is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Regulatory Studies. He has recently produced a report about the alcoholic beverage control system. You can find that at johnlock.org, but John is here to tell us all about what is in this report. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
Controlling liquor, does that date back to the days of Prohibition or even earlier than that in North Carolina?
Well, it dates back to state prohibition in North Carolina, which preceded federal prohibition by a number of years.
And people may not realize that. Most people, when you think of controlling liquor, you think of the 1930s.
Yeah. You normally think of federal prohibition, but North Carolina had started back in 1908 when we prohibited the sale of alcohol.
Tell us what happened back in 08 and why that came to be.
Well, it came to be after a number of years where legislators and concerned citizens wanted to get rid of alcoholic sales in North Carolina, and they were eventually successful in being able to put a vote on the ballots and were able to get people to ban it.
Then comes federal prohibition, and then, of course, we know that prohibition was repealed. So what happened when prohibition was repealed, did North Carolina just get back into this business?
State policymakers realized they needed to get back into the business because they looked at the maps and saw that about two-thirds of North Carolinians were going either north to Virginia or south to South Carolina to get beer and wine and liquor.
What did they decide to do?
They decided to create the state alcoholic beverage control system, which allowed counties, if they passed the vote, to allow liquor sales, but it was under heavy state control.
And what's the theory behind the control? Is it just concerns about excessive drinking, or are there other issues involved?
Yes, mostly concerns about getting too much access, and that retailers would have a financial interest in continuing to ply people with liquor, even if they were completely trashed. So it was definitely concerns about the public safety aspects of it. In fact, it's regulated under public safety.
I can tell you that my husband and I moved to North Carolina from Arizona, and the way that liquor is available and handled is very different. And we were kind of surprised. We didn't know what an ABC store was when we moved to North Carolina. Help us understand how North Carolina controls liquor and how other states do this.
North Carolina is one of 17 states considered a control state, and that means, in general, the state controls the wholesale and retail distribution. What makes North Carolina unique among control states is that while the government controls the wholesale, the retail is handled by local governments through their ABC boards.
It sounds very, very complex and heavy on bureaucracy, all sorts of boards and people who make decisions.
Yeah, and one of the things I tried to do in the report is give a flow chart of how this system works, because it is very complex. It's very Byzantine and confusing, especially if someone comes from out of state, like you mentioned. It's just a maze of bureaucracy.
Because you can go to a grocery store. You can go to all sorts of stores and buy beers, buy wines, but you can't buy spirits.
Right. Which is, I think, one of the confusing facts of it is that we make a distinction between spirits and beer and wine. If we are worried about the intoxicating effects of alcohol, you would think that we would have control the other way. But here's the thing. They're all legal products. And so if we're going to treat them as legal products, then we should all treat them the same way, I think.
Explain to us more about the difference in how beer and wine are treated in terms of the customer's perspective and also the producer's perspective versus someone who is producing or trying to buy, say, whiskey.
Well, in this state, it's a licensed state for those aspects. And so beer producer, wine producer can go to a wholesaler who will then take their products to a retailer, and that will reach the customer. Whereas if you are a distillery, you have to convince the ABC Commission to list your product, at which point the product can be stored in the ABC warehouse, at which point the ABC board, the local, one of the 433 local boards can one of the local boards can decide to put it in one of their stores. Then they order it from the warehouse, and then they list it in the store.
So if you are someone who's producing some sort of specialty whiskey and you want to be able to sell it, does that mean you have to go around to multiple boards and try to convince people that this is a product that they should have on the shelves at their local ABC store?
Yeah, that's part of the problem. Once you get listed by the commission, you still have to convince that the local boards to have it in your store.
John, that sounds like that is so complicated and so bureaucratic and costly to someone who is in the production business. Why would they even bother? It seems like it's a disincentive to even be in the business.
It does function as a disincentive, and that's one of the reasons I believe that we have had so few distilleries coming back, despite so many more breweries and wineries coming back.
That's interesting. What's the disparity like between the industries?
There are over 300 breweries now. There are nearly 200 wineries, not quite 200 wineries, but only 57 distilleries. Now, to put this in context, before 1908, North Carolina was the nation's leader in number of distilleries. And we also were the nation's leader in selling wine products.
I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion that there are a few members of the General Assembly who, like you, believe that this is outdated, like the John Locke Foundation, and think that it's time to change this. So in order to go about that, what would be the steps that North Carolina would take to wrest loose some of this control from these local boards?
You know, cut the Gordian knot when it comes to the boards. Just get rid of them. That would get rid of a, that would be a huge improvement in the system. Think about privatizing. Think about serving and treating distilleries the same as breweries and wineries, and liquor the same as beer and wine. And then, I mean, just rethink the entire code when it comes
because
to that.
Because other states don't have this type of control system. Some do, but as you mentioned, the local component is exclusive to North Carolina.
Right.
But are there other states that we can model ourselves after if we wanted to open this and make it a freer market?
There are many other states that have many other good ideas, and that's one of the things I'm working on in my next report. Every state has its own unique system, and you know, if you think about the states as laboratories of democracy, then we have seen numerous laboratories in this field.
We've been talking with John Sanders. He's Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.